Hello, this is What We Just Watched from TV Cream. I'm Chris.
And I'm Graham.
This is the podcast happening in which we meet...
Hello.
Hello. And then discuss two programmes that we've brought along with us.
However, Chris doesn't know what I'm about to show him. And I don't know what Chris is about to show me.
But which should we look at first?
Well, this could have been the source of some rancour. But before coming here today, Chris and I were set a chess challenge composed by Bill Hartston from the holiday morning programme Play Chess. Now, while I stumbled over this because, as far as I could see, each of Black's 19 legal replies allowed an immediate mate.
I solved it in one brilliant move. The black and white pawns don't fight each other. They join forces.
I still dispute the legitimacy of that. Because
which means we begin with my choice of viewing. Right, here we go with my show.
Oh, tripods.
Oh, got it in one.
Fucking hell, okay.
I'm not sure how to react to that. So what are we seeing?
Well, it's... Who's that music by? Well, it's the logo, isn't it? It's sort of a majestic sweep around the logo. It's
Ken Freeman, I think.
Ken Freeman. I used to have that on the BBC theme tunes. But it's quite a stately opening.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
And very confident just to go straight into a,
I think so,
a logo.
Yeah. Yeah, so we're just getting the credits, the writer and the adapter and the director. So we're going to watch the first ever episode of The Tripods. So we've just watched the first episode of The Tripods, broadcast on BBC One on Saturday, 15th of September, 1984. And I was really keen, Graham, to see what your reaction was going to be to that show. I wasn't sure whether I was going to see sort of unrestrained glee or whether you were going to curl a lip slightly. What were your first feelings when you saw the opening title sequence?
Well, my reaction is a complicated reaction because my loyalty has to go to Doctor Who, which would have finished the season 21 earlier in that year.
Yeah.
Doctor Who fans have to have an animosity towards any other science fiction program
launched by the BBC. Animals.
Yes. In the same way that we have a complicated relationship with the Dukes of Hazzard, which had the slot... Buck Rogers and 25th Century on ITV. Yeah. Anything that could have chiselled away at Doctor Who.
Right. I was just going to mention, actually, in the Guardian's TV listings, it says, it describes the Tripods as a treat for young sci-fi buffs missing you-know-who. So, leaving aside your affinity to Doctor Who, would you have been in the target audience for the Tripods?
I would. And I think... I mean, my recollection of the Tripods has been polluted somewhat by Blue Peter, but in the way that... Blue Peter would pollute one's recollection of Box of Delights or Narnia adaptations.
It's one of those shows that they really got behind on Blue Peter, wasn't it?
If you're keen on television trickery and special effects, I bet you are glued to your set every Saturday when it's Tripods time.
So let's talk about the episode we just watched. And really interestingly, we start with a cold open. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but was it a bit of a rarity in 1984 for a British TV drama to start in that way?
Yes, I think it was, actually. I'm not sure how grabby a cold open was.
I liked it a lot. Let's talk about what actually happened. So we actually open on a scene of a sort of English village, which looks like it might have been a couple of hundred years ago. Mm. And we get a caption which says, "A village in England, July 2089 AD.
And everyone goes,
oh, what's going on here? Yeah. We appear to be in the past, but we're acting in the future. What's going on? And so kind of all these village scenes kind of start to form. We get kind of people bringing it. They're preparing for a feast, aren't they?
Mm.
And then we kind of alight on this character called Jack, who's sort of dressed like this sort of kind of Shoreditch hipster.
Yeah.
So we're preparing for some kind of ceremony, aren't we? And it emerges that he is going to be capped by a tripod.
Mm.
This is your day, Jack.
I think the highlight of that sequence is the emergence of the tripod itself.
Mm.
We should say here that when people look back on the tripods now, they're a bit of a figure of fun, aren't they? They're kind of regarded as not being terribly well done.
Mm.
And also, people tend to think that there's a lack of tripods in the tripods, that we don't see them often enough.
Yeah.
But the one that we see in the show is very well done. It's a model, isn't it? Mm. And there's also a kind of life-size leg, which...
Well, I think the director makes some very canny choices and really plays to the limitations. And so the classic tripod shot that you get, and you see it a few times in this episode, is the tripod looming out of the background with something, normally trees, maybe a mountain, which is usefully... masking the problematic area of the tripod, which is the legs and how it moves along. And as long as you're not having to see the tripod actually walking, then it's very successful. And also you have the lovely, that kind of chill in the music that whenever one emerges, the Ken Freeman sort of synth chill. One thing that I think is fascinating, I know it's based on a series of books which I've never read. If they were launching a new sci-fi show today for however the Guardian described the potential audience, young viewers missing Doctor Who, would it have such a kind of rural idiom? Because I actually watching that, I think that seems quite unusual now.
I think you're right, because we've been transported back to the past, but it's very much a kind of sort of Enid Blyton vision of the past. You know, there's kind of there's kind of lots of wood chopping and kind of people shoeing horses, and you know, there's these kind of great feasts of, you know, loaves of bread and so on. I think you're right. I think that'd be a difficult sell now.
If they're doing it now, it would be in a world plunge back into the past, but within a city.
Yeah.
So you would have all the kind of urban decay.
Yeah.
But also in the 80s, it seemed to be that a rural setting was the province of children's telly and fiction.
Absolutely.
So things like Brendan Chase, for example.
I was thinking there is a sort of Wednesday 10 past 5 sort of feel to the tripods, but in a slightly bigger budget way. But I kind of tended to feel that kind of... I struggle to put my finger on this, but it feels that this whole kind of idea of it's the future, but it's also the past.
Mm.
There needs to be a word for that. You know, like steampunk?
Mm.
There needs to be a word to describe that whole kind of sci-fi milieu.
It's quite a complicated idea that we're joining a world where humanity has already lost this war.
Yeah.
But it's not a world of freedom fighters. It's a world where they're actually complicit now in being subjugated.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is a very kind of complicated... And I wondered if that's part of the reason why in this opening 25 minutes, there is not one single gag.
No, that's true.
No one says anything funny. Everyone's very solemn.
Yeah. And I wonder whether when they were making those choices, they decided to rigorously adhere to the logic that in a world where kind of... The process of capping, we are told, kind of robs people when they're 16 years old. It robs them of their inquisitiveness and their sense of wonder.
Mm.
And we can assume that they're kind of like your sense of humour is also sort of, you know, removed and erased.
I think as we were watching, you pointed out there's a scene with John Scott Martin as a school teacher who's sort of delivering a quasi sermon about how they've got to be where they are.
Yeah.
It is surprising, but no accident, that many of our great celebrations, Capping Day, which we all enjoyed yesterday, and, say, September's Harvest Festival, stand so close together in our calendar. For nature and the tripods are the two essentials for the continuation and well-being of mankind.
And actually, everything works very, very well.
Consider the unthinkable barbarity of deliberately killing other human beings, and how it must have been in the dark days before the tripods came.
My problem, though, with watching it is that it doesn't ever really establish what's... Not that I'm saying I'm in favour of a totalitarian regime, but it doesn't establish...
That's fine, if you want to, Graham, that's fine.
What's wrong with the current status quo? They're all living in quite nice houses.
Yeah.
They're all learning sort of nice old trades.
Yeah.
Everyone seems quite happy.
Yeah.
So there isn't really a sense of... I mean, there is Will who's anxious about the idea of being capped, but it's never shown actually as capping is is a bad thing.
Mm. It's quite arbitrary that it's just decided by the author that he doesn't like. He's not in favour of it, and he's against it.
Mm. As a production and as an episode, I think it's okay. It's quite good, but because it's so solemn, everyone talks in that sort of weird declamatory style. So he meets, it's Ozymandias, isn't he?
Who is yes.
And they have this thing whereby they use full names.
So yeah, says, Will Parker.
Men made these Will Parker.
Men made these Will Parker.
It's this kind of Baroque kind of sort of sci-fi kind of way of talking.
Mm.
And, you know, kind of, we call it the White Mountains. I do you no favours. Very few make it. Actually, the thing that it kind of reminded me of is, and this is something very much of the period, is the Fighting Fantasy game books by Steve Jackson and Ian Livingston, which kind
The White Mountains could have been a title.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Quest for the White Mountains.
I kind of want to play that now.
a profound issue, isn't it, is the acting is so dreadful.
There's no getting around that. The two lead actors are not great.
No, and it's actually, I found it quite hard to even follow what they're saying sometimes, because the intonation doesn't lead you anywhere in anything that they're saying.
Yeah.
I knew you were up to something.
Keep your voice down.
Where are you going?
Nowhere.
You're going to tell me everything, or I wake Uncle John.
And it's Jim Baker, isn't he, who plays Henry. Mm-hmm. He is particularly bad. Will himself is quite a charisma vacuum.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Henry is...
He's not great. And he also gets saddled with the worst line in the entire episode, where he decides that he is going to follow Will on his journey to
these loony mountains of yours.
That really should have come out in the first draft. So we talk a bit about kind of the themes that are going on here. I mean, it's quite difficult to sort of judge old sci-fi, I think, in that kind of... It's very difficult for him not to look hackneyed. In terms of the themes, you know, kind of we've got kind of, it's a kind of post-apocalyptic world. There's these kind of machines which are in themselves sort of, let's be generous, an homage to the War of the Worlds. It doesn't feel particularly original now. Do you think it felt original in 1984?
I think the idea of a society that has become retrogressive is an interesting idea.
Yeah.
But is it an interesting idea for a kid's serial? I'm not so sure it is.
I think you might be on the money there. I mean, I did have a look at the author John Christopher's sort of output, and pretty much all of his books seem, sort of with the distance of 20, 30 years, to be pretty derivative. You know, there's a lot of plagues, there's a new ice age. He's very big on sort of post-apocalyptic societies. And, you know, there's no reflection on the quality of his work, but, you know, it all feels pretty derivative. But maybe there are only a few sort of handful of sort of sci-fi themes that kind of only get endlessly sort of recycled and mashed together.
Isn't it interesting that it's 25 minutes? Because they're clearly doing that because Doctor Who
is...
Does it do it any favours or not, do you think?
I don't think so. It felt pretty... I mean, although it did set up the entire premise for the series quite neatly, it felt a little bit unsatisfying. You get this very brief snapshot of their lives, and then they're going on a quest. And it feels kind of slightly serendipitous that kind of Will is singled out by the Ozymandias character. Why don't you go to the White Mountains? Okay.
It was a delight, though, wasn't it, to see, as you spotted, Laura Regan's mum from Grange Hill.
Laura!
Let's talk a bit about the subtext of the series. Capping, do we think that is just sort of a kind of allegory for our youth? Do you think that when we're 16, we're all sort of capped in a way, all our kind of... all our wonder and curiosity were stamped on by the man.
Yeah, I mean that could have been a more potent element. It's a world where, as often is in this kind of fiction, where kids know the truth.
Yeah,
and adults are all part of the problem.
Yeah,
apart from adults who are made to look as subversive and antisocial, like Ozymandias. And what's the phrase they use for those people?
The vagrants.
And the vagrants. Yeah. So that's they always like to have a kind of a catch-all phrase, don't they, for the people who are first posited as being troublesome or pests, who then turn out to.
But secretly they hold the truth.
But again, I mean, there's nothing that seems adolescent about Will or Henry in terms of how they talk to each other or how
Or Henry's got a yo-yo at one point.
It's as good as it gets.
I think if we're going to talk about the sort of the direction, the production of the show, I think it's quite nicely directed. There's some kind of handheld camera going on in there, which is probably kind of quite new at the time. The incidental music and the theme music, which are by Ken Freeman, who later did the theme from Casualty. That's lovely, isn't it?
Well, it's... I mean, everything about those titles are great. They're so bold and simple. You could have imagined that, for example, there might have been a... They might have wanted to tell more of the story of the tripods in the title. So they don't do anything like that. They've just got a nice 3D stencily font of tripods, which they then... The camera gradually sort of moves around.
Yeah.
The thing that I did find interesting... when we talk about Ken Freeman going on to do Casualty, is that the actual credits appear in the same way that the Casualty credits did. This kind of, how would you describe it? It's almost like lightning, isn't it?
Yeah. It's really nice.
Out the letters.
And I'm trying to work out whether that was done on a computer or not, whether it's animated.
I would have, looking at that, to me it looks like it was, that would have been cell animation.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the tripod's logo, that is early 3D animation. And then you get over the end, you get a kind of an even slower, more statesman-like take on the music, don't you?
Yeah. Well, interestingly, Ken Freeman played keyboards on Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds, so kind of there's a kind of neat link into the tripods.
Wow. Now, if I may, the most exciting thing that happens in the episode, in the version that we watched, and so thank you for bringing along this version, is that, about halfway through, a caption appears on screen.
Yes.
The caption reads, "The Princess of Wales has given birth to a son this afternoon. There will be a news report at 5:40.
I know.
And the caption attributes this to BBC One, but it's BBC Dash One.
I mean, just kind of the sheer lack of brand guidelines at that point. It's kind of, it's appalling. Really,
I wonder if this was still the era when they did BBC TV, but the T and V in lowercase as well.
Yeah, very possibly. But I do wonder whether, you know, Prince Harry, for it was he, you know, is aware that, you know, the news of his birth was broadcast to the nation in this way.
We had a little look, didn't we, at the news.
Now, before the next programme, we go over to the newsroom.
We did, which was kind of presented to the nation by a what can only be described as a gleeful Jan Leeming.
The Princess of Wales has had her baby, and it's a boy.
She'd clearly been briefed as they're about to go on the air. Put a smile in the voice.
Yeah.
And so a lot of correspondence with their microphones on long cables. But they're all at locations where things haven't happened yet.
Yes.
The traditional way of announcing the birth, that is a statement on Buckingham Palace railings, hasn't yet been put there.
And then... the next show on that night was Noel Edmonds' The Late Late Breakfast Show.
Yes.
Of course, well, Noel loves anything that's
newsworthy.
Newsworthy.
Making headlines.
The kind of the febrile side of live television.
Yes.
Could only happen right now.
And so, the magic of live television.
And so he arrives on set and he's holding one of his golden eggs.
Yes, kind of sort of dressed as a baby boy, if you can sort of imagine the conceit.
For the first time, I'm actually going to start with two firsts. I've never presented a golden egg award at the beginning of the Late Late Breakfast Show. And for the first time, the millions out there know something that the people here don't know. We heard on the news a few moments ago that the Princess of Wales gave birth to a little baby boy. Just an hour or so ago.
There were three books in the Tripod series. It was intended that would be a TV series of 13 episodes for each of those books. And only the first two books got turned into TV series. Mm. It was cancelled after the second series.
I think scripts were written for a third, weren't they?
I think so. Did you watch any more episodes after the first one?
My memory of it is vague, so I think I probably didn't. I think I might have returned for the first of the second series.
Yeah.
I do have memories of them when they're in... I think they do reach the White Mountains. I remember seeing a kind of... They do encounter an alien, don't they? A sort of a tripod-esque alien with a big... big green alien with a with a singular eye.
Yes, in the classic tradition.
But otherwise, I can't remember anything else about it. I mean, it's...
I think it's regarded as a series which was slow and sluggish and...
Just got slower.
Yeah, and as I've alluded to before, didn't have quite enough tripods in it. Mm. For all the kind of the good things about that first episode, and I think there are good things about it, you can see the seeds of its downfall as well, can't you? So that was the tripods, and now it's time to watch Graham's show.
So, Chris, after the slightly languorous pace of the tripods,
okay,
this hopefully is going to kick us up a gear.
Okay. Oh, amazing. So we're watching Beat the Teacher. We're watching sort of computer-generated noughts and crosses. Zooming in, we're moving into the board, and the logo is appearing, and Beat the Teacher.
The host being, quickly.
Howard Stableford.
Yep. Okay, so we're going to watch Beat the Teacher, and then we shall report back. We've just watched the very first episode of Beat the Teacher, which aired on the 24th of September 1984 at 4:15 p.m. between Mighty Mouse and Dungeons and Dragons. It was hosted by Howard Stableford, and the series saw school kids and teachers fight for supremacy of a mechanical noughts and crosses board by correctly answering trivia questions. It was devised, of course, by Clive Doig and produced by Ian Oliver. And the episode we watched pitted Susie from Impington Village in Cambridge, who was playing noughts, against geography teacher Mr. Hannon from Fortismere in North London. What did you think of the very first episode of Beat the Teacher?
Well, I enjoyed it. I think I have to say I enjoyed it mainly for nostalgic reasons rather than reasons of quality.
Really?
I'm not saying it's bad, but there are things that kind of, at a distance of 30 or so years, sort of slightly niggled with me.
Okay, we'll get into that. Now, it was Howard Stableford. See, I found him quite effervescent.
Yeah.
Maybe, and amusing.
Maybe slightly a little too effervescent at times.
10-0, plenty of time to go, jokers to be played and that sort of thing.
I could sense that at times you were sort of prickling.
Well, he's the sort of person who kind of, if he has to say something slightly officious or awkward, he will lapse into a kind of comedy voice.
But you don't think that's just jollying things along and making... He's making AdMed fun.
He is, but I think I can forgive him first show nerves.
And do you remember how he specifically billed on this opening episode?
He is the chairman. That job title is redolent of a different era, when the role of the person presenting a quiz or a game would also be charged with keeping order and, you know, officiating and looking after the rules. I think we kind of tend to take those things granted for now. Alexander Armstrong is not the chairman of Pointless, is he?
But because I think being a chairman comes with responsibilities, one of them is that it becomes apparent that Howard has chatted to everybody, because a lot of the times he says such and such tells me that they want to be this when they grow up.
It's a nice touch.
So do you like to think that perhaps when everyone arrives at the BBC studios, it's Howard who's maybe there and saying, here are some sandwiches.
He's very much at large in the green room, I feel.
Hello and welcome to Beat the Teacher.
Something that I think you and I both found instantly pleasing was how Howard was dressed.
Well, he is wearing a logo sweatshirt, which I think all TV quiz show hosts should do.
It makes me think of the wider issue of the sweatshirt itself. Now, I was once, and please forgive my bragging, but I was once in the fortunate position of chatting to Neil Buchanan. And he said to me that he felt that his claim to fame was he was the last person on British television to wear a sweatshirt.
Well, I applaud him for that.
Do you agree with that, though? I mean, do sweatshirts exist, really, as an item of leisure wear?
I'm not sure that they do. I think kind of there was a time when the sweatshirt was writ large into the fabric of British television. I think if you imagine someone, you wanted to denote a character who was sort of living a life of leisure, they would be wearing a sweatshirt, wouldn't they?
But in a role where you're chairing proceedings, a sweatshirt says that I have authority,
yes,
but I have a sense of humour. I mean, another classic exponent of the sweatshirt would have been David Hargreaves on Science Workshop.
Hello. This enormous engine was built more than 130 years ago to pump London's water.
I think so, and I think we can all recall the quest that Malcolm, his co-presenter, embarked on because he could never get the Science Workshop sweatshirt.
Yeah, so I think maybe what I'm saying is that you need to have a sweatshirt. It works in the context of something which has an educational element,
yeah,
but is still actually going to just be a lot of fun.
It wants to brand education as fun. I think that comes through very much in Beat the Teacher.
I also like the fact that Howard... We've established that he's trying to be very affable, but I think there is a sense of he's slightly annoyed at a couple of etiquette cock-ups that are made, particularly by Mr. Hannon. So there is a bit where Mr. Hannon answers and hasn't pressed his buzzer.
Mm.
Rant, Mr. Hannon got that right without pressing his buzzer. Three moves.
There's also an issue which I think hasn't been resolved at any point in discussion around the show or shooting the show, which is, are they allowed to consult with the audience?
Yeah.
So there's a bit, for example, where the young girl, Susie, she's clearly been informed by her teammates.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Howard says...
You took a whisper there and they got it wrong behind you.
There's another bit where he says...
Susie, what do you think? Looks over the shoulder trying to get some advice. Crafty one, this.
Do you sort of think Howard should really just let that go?
I don't think that should be allowed. But I think clearly... It should be resolved one way or the other, whether you're allowed to consult or not.
Mm.
I don't think he could just sort of let it slide.
Maybe it's a kind of he's raging against this. He has a kind of an impotence, doesn't he, in this, in that he doesn't think it should be going on.
Mm.
It clearly is going on. Everyone else seems to be fine about it going on. Did you notice then when Susie and Mr. Hannon come to their places?
Yes, yeah.
There is a name baton.
I thought that was a nice touch.
And the baton, they have to turn it round to you.
So,
like
there's four potential contestants from each school, all of whom get a go of playing the game during the four shows in the week.
Mm.
So each of their names is on one side of this four-sided sort of baton, and so they have to kind of turn it over to their own name, so that's on display throughout the show. I quite like that as a little conceit.
So do you like, because there are some certain physical accoutrements. So for example, when someone has played their Joker, which that is an oversized card, isn't it?
It is, yes, and quite a flimsy one, I have to say.
And their Joker allows them to invert what's on
the
noughts and crosses board, but then how it produces a physical egg timer. Do you like seeing that?
I like seeing the egg timer. It did just make me think that at some point when they were formatting the game and coming up with the rules, they realised that they would actually have to come up with some kind of artificial device from one player playing the Joker and then the other player playing their Joker immediately afterwards, which is, you know, obviously what would happen. So you have to construct this artificial device to stop that happening.
I was intrigued by the fact that in both occasions Howard laboured the point that the next question, so when someone plays the Joker, they then have to answer the subsequent question correctly to claim the new points on the board.
Yeah.
And Howard, he really belaboured the fact that it's not a special question now, it's just the next one coming. Do you appreciate that kind of fastidiousness?
To be honest, I don't. And I thought Howard was apt to labour the point again later in the show where 2 minutes from the end of the game and 1 minute from the end of the game, we hear this sort of... It's a kind of bird noise.
Well, and I thought, you know, to Beat the Teacher, why isn't it a bell? It seems very dissonant to have a duck quack.
A rather strange sound means that it's the end of the game.
Well, I could see you looking at times visibly uncomfortable with some of the style of questions.
Well, I wanted to talk about this because it's not a quiz, is it? It's not a quiz in... displaying one's knowledge. There's no... Are there any questions about...
There's nothing about facts.
There's nothing about facts. It's all sort of lateral thinking, isn't it?
But that's integral to the format, isn't it? Because the idea is to make it a level playing field.
I think so.
Pupil and teacher.
But I prefer the sort of more fact-based quiz to the style of questions. It feels a bit like kind of one of those adverts for Mensa you used to get in newspapers. What's the next one in this sequence?
And I wasn't sure that actually all of them
all of these kind of riddle me puzzles and lateral thinking puzzles quite cohered, because some of them, the actual explanation is quite woolly. I'd noted down Careful Carl's career.
What would you think is Careful Carl's career of this list? Careful Carl's career, which do you think it might be? Cameraman, computer programmer, car salesman?
So the answer is car salesman. The reason it's the answer is because C-A-R is the first three letters of Careful Carl's career. It doesn't feel very satisfying as an answer, does it?
Mm. But did you perk up as I did when there was an observation round? Because I like that in a quiz.
Do you know what? I didn't enjoy the observation round at all. My attention wandered somewhat, because we were given kind of a couple of minutes or slightly less to look at this scene from a gallery. It's just basically a static image backed by some music.
There's a highbrow joke there as well, which I found very pleasing, because that whole sequence is backed by Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition. Reimagined by someone at the Radiophonic Workshop.
Pencils and paper there. You can jot anything down you like. Might be worthwhile.
In a style that Howard describes as...
a bit of plinkety-plonky music.
Plinkety-plonkety music. But do you like that there is that extra layer?
I like the fact that they've gone the extra mile to put that reference in.
Mm.
But that wasn't my favourite question of the show, I have to say.
Now, I remember when the series first came out, the thing that was most appealing to me was the board.
Yes.
Now, even now, I still find something hugely satisfying about the kind of the clickety-clack of the rotating books.
And it goes from blank to naught to blank to cross and so on.
Is it still something that works for you?
I think so. Visually and orally, it's quite satisfying. And also, it extends an extra layer of gameplay, in that the contestants have to remember where the noughts and crosses are behind the blank spaces on the board.
Do you know who stole that format?
I don't.
Rob Curling.
Of course, Rob Curling. Who I feel is very much a sort of brother-in-arms of Howard Stableford in a televisual sense.
And I like, you know, the kind of... he stole that format, but then he popped a lake in the studio, in the middle of the studio, to kind of deflect any accusations. He would say, well, no, this is a very innovative show. We have a lake installed in, well, more of a pond, but a water feature, which Howard could have only dreamt of. That thought petered out a little bit. The other thing that goes along with the noughts and crosses board, and it's something I can't, again, get enough of, is the theme and the reprise of the theme. Do you like hearing it over and over?
I do, actually. It kind of sort of underpins the brand quite satisfyingly. Mm. And it's kind of a nice sort of little punctuation point in the game.
That means that the joker is held up and all the symbols on the board are reversed, so that noughts become crosses and vice versa.
It's very much on a par with Blockbusters, in which that was also a game played on a board which continually repeated a section from the theme tune.
Mm.
Ruth.
Mercy.
Mercy is correct.
It sort of almost burns the show into your consciousness. Anyone of our generation would immediately know the Blockbusters theme.
Mm.
I think most of us would know the Beat the Teacher theme.
And the Beat the Teacher theme as written by Mike Batt.
Well, I didn't know that until today.
And then very much in consort with that music is the opening title.
Yes.
Now, I know you have a gripe. We'll get to that in a minute if you can still, contain your rage about this. And it's a very valid gripe. But I think there was a point in the mid-1980s where logos seemed more agreeable at a 30-degree slant. And this is very much
I think you're very much onto something there.
Now let's get to your gripe with these opening titles, Chris, because you were very angry.
Well, I was angry then, and I'm slightly less angry about it now, but it did irk me when I saw it. But if you watch the opening titles of Beat the Teacher, one of the yellow O's, I think, I think it's the middle
yellow, the one through which the show we resolve into the show.
When the title of the show appears and resolves on screen, that middle O sort of comes loose from its moorings.
We should be calling it a naught. This is the proper phraseology.
but it comes loose from its moorings in order to make room for the show title.
So the naught is actually floating within its box on the naught.
Yeah, it doesn't quite come out of the box, does it? But all the other noughts and crosses stay in the right place, but this one moves, and it's really unsatisfying. Once you see it, you can't unsee it.
And if you were the producer, if you were Clive Doig or Ian Oliver, and you've met the gentleman who's rendered this for you on a computer,
I would have picked that up at the
and
meeting.
Then they would say to you, "Well, like, we don't have the technology at the moment to keep a naught in."
I would have argued the point quite firmly that it should have stayed in place.
So would you even have said, "Well, in that case, I don't want to zooming in on that naught."
I think so. I would have asked them to do whatever they needed to do to avoid that slightly displeasing effect.
Okay. The last specific detail I want to talk about is that punctuates the show throughout. Where do you think it became established that an audience of children have to cheer rather than clap?
It seems very much of this era. I don't recall them doing a lot of cheering on screen tests.
No.
If we're talking about BBC children's quiz shows, I don't remember a lot of cheering on screen tests. But they cheered on Finders Keepers
and Cheggers Plays Pop.
Oh, I think Cheggers Plays Pop is the tipping point from the clapping to the cheering, and it's a very specific kind of cheering, isn't it? It's way.
Thank you. Now, the eerie coincidence, Chris, is that we have picked two shows from autumn 1984.
Yes.
Is there anything we can conclude about that?
I'm not sure that there is. I mean, they were broadcast 9 days apart. Mm. I think perhaps what we're seeing is as the start of a sort of a new era on BBC One.
Mm.
One of them is a Saturday evening family drama serial. Mm. One is a children's quiz game. But it does feel like the BBC has decided that the 80s start now.
Mm.
So there's a whole new kind of rush of programmes coming through the schedules, both through the autumn of 1984 and the early months of 1985. Mm.
I would say without reservation that Beat the Teacher, for me, is the more successful of the two programmes.
I think it's more successful at what it set out to do. The Tripods, obviously, was a more ambitious failure, if you like. And Beat the Teacher is a less ambitious success.
You've been listening to What We Just Watched from TV Cream, in which we watched The Tripods from the 15th of September 1984
and Beat the Teacher from the 24th of September also in 1984.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.